Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. Happy Monday to you. My name is Mark Shiver. So glad, as always, to have you listening to our podcast. We have a great show lined up for you today. We'll be talking with our good friend, Dr. Susan Roberts. Of course, she is at Davidson College, professor of political science. We always have great, great interviews with her, and I'm looking forward to getting her insights, her post-election analysis, and what we can expect going forward if, in fact, for example, Roy Cooper is the next governor. Now, let's look at what's been going on over the weekend, and I'm not going to stay too long on this point, but, you know, we're hearing a lot about the need on college campuses for safe spaces, and particularly University of Michigan, I believe it was, rolling out Play-Doh and coloring books for college students because they're upset about the results of the election. Folks, really, I mean, you know, I don't want to belittle people's feelings in any way. I know that there are some people who feel concerned that somehow, because Donald Trump was elected president, that their lives and their safety is at risk. But we're talking about institutions of higher learning that receive tax dollars and that we entrust our kids to go and receive an education. And they're treating these young adults, okay, they're not middle school or high school students. We're talking about college students. They're being treated as if they were toddlers. And I, for one, don't really think this is appropriate, particularly at schools that receive tax dollars. We're going to give you Play-Doh. We're going to give you pillows, coloring books. You know, really, I mean, can you think about it this way? If Hillary Clinton had won, do you think that conservative young college students would be crying and needing safe places and coloring books and Play-Doh and granola bars that they were serving at NC State and things like that? Do you really think that this would be going on? Absolutely not. We've had President Obama for the last two presidential terms. He won twice. I don't recall any college students crying and being concerned. You know, if as a person of faith, let's say a Christian, for example, were on a college campus and they said, well, you know, I'm really concerned about my rights to free speech. Can I have a safe space, please? They would laugh them off the campus because people of faith are treated negatively and adversely on college campuses. The greatest thing that we have in America is our freedom, our right to vote, the peaceful transfer of power. Not everybody's candidate is going to win. And so as a nation, it's really the protesting, in fact, that's another topic altogether, but it's a slap in the face to freedom. People got out, they voted, the people have spoken, and that should be it. If you're upset, fine. But, you know, if you're an adult, do you really need to be playing with Play-Doh? I don't know. Maybe you do. You know, I was having this conversation over the weekend with several different people, and, you know, I was informed that I just didn't have empathy. I didn't understand. Look, I understand that nobody likes to lose. But the bottom line is we're talking about young adults. We're not talking about children. We're talking about kids who are in college and who are learning life lessons. And trust me, when you go and you enter the workforce, you're not going to be given a safe space, a pillow to lie down on if you don't get the job that you wanted. Okay? You're going to be expected to just suck it up and move on. And so I'm really concerned about this precedent that is being set on college campuses. I really believe that it's setting kids up to fail, telling them that it's okay to not be strong in the face of adversity or losing, as in this case, losing an election. Their guy didn't win. All of a sudden, they're upset. They're concerned. Maybe there are, and okay, let me go back. I will say this. There are people on the edge of every movement, whether it be the right or the left or anything in between. There are people who give a bad name to whether it's the right or the left. They do extreme things. And those are not, by and large, the people who elected and voted for Donald Trump. There are some racists everywhere, not just among Trump voters. And there are those who are saying things that are wrong, totally uncalled for. But by and large, as a movement across the country, we're seeing in college campuses a response to an election that is just frankly bizarre. People protesting, people crying, needing safe spaces. Somebody's now come out this thing where you can wear a safety pin, acknowledging that you're a safe person or that where you are is a safe space. Well, where is the Obama administration and where is the outcry when Christians are being beheaded by ISIS? Just a thought, just a question, I don't know. But I really think that we need to take a look, a real long, hard look at who we are as a nation, you know, and stop handing out participation trophies for kids that lose, you know, in sports, and begin to raise students with an awareness and understanding that life is often not easy, often not going to go the way you want it to. And the response to that is not pulling out a coloring book. Anyway, Bob Harris, who is at the Carolina Partnership for Reform, wrote an interesting article on another topic, as we change gears here, called The Atkinson Precedent. With 60,000 provisional ballots yet to be counted, Harris writes, Roy Cooper leads 48.97 to 48.86, a 4,979 vote lead out of over 4,600,000 total voters. He says, is this an unprecedented cliffhanger? And the answer is no. Go back to 2004. Democrat June Atkinson led Republican Bill Fletcher for superintendent of public instruction by 8,500 votes out of 3.3 million. The Democrat General Assembly short-circuited a Republican Supreme Court at that time and gave Atkinson the victory in a vote of the legislature. Fletcher challenged the votes, and the Supreme Court ruled that out-of-precinct voting was authorized in the law. They also ruled that a constitutional provision allowing the General Assembly to decide disputed elections for Council of State offices, including governor, was no longer valid because the General Assembly had deleted the legal procedures for doing so in 1971, which, by the way, Harris writes, for a reason no one in 2004 could explain. The Democrat legislature responded with a law removing the courts and substituting the General Assembly as the body to decide a disputed election and specifically allowing out-of-precinct voting. In fact, the sponsor, Senator Claude Felter, he gloried in kicking the courts out of the Democrats' way. At that time, the Carolina Journal reported Claude Felter is quoted by the AP as saying the state courts should never have gotten involved in the Atkinson-Fletcher race in the first place. So Republicans quickly filed a federal lawsuit against the power play. And of course, Attorney General Roy Cooper was the defendant on the side of the power play. Cooper and the Democrats got the lawsuit quashed, and the General Assembly announced June Atkinson as the victor. That's pretty crazy, folks. I had forgotten all about that. Did you remember that? I didn't. So here's the question. Could we see something like that happen here in 2016? Where the General Assembly says, oh, by the way, we're going to stick ourselves right in the middle of this, and Pat McCrory's the winner. Oh, that would make some people very happy, wouldn't it? Anyway, politics in North Carolina, as you know, is never dull, folks, and that's why we're here, to keep you informed on what matters in North Carolina. And also going on right now are rumors that the General Assembly, when they meet to allocate funding for the folks involved in the devastation of Hurricane Matthew, well, they might just decide to go ahead and expand the North Carolina Supreme Court, with the idea being that if Roy Cooper does in fact win, that Governor McCrory, before he leaves office, could appoint two conservative Supreme Court justices and tilt the court back to a conservative leaning. I don't know if that's really going to get any traction or not, but that's the word that's out there. And of course, there's, gambling involved there. Number one, is would Governor McCrory appoint folks that could be relied on to be conservatives? And number two, the people would not be real pleased, I don't think, with that kind of power play. However, there is precedent for that. I believe Tony Rand and Senator Bassnight back in the day did something similar with the North Carolina Court of Appeals. So even though the election is over, folks, there is still a lot going on, and we will keep you up to date and informed with what matters in North Carolina. I'd like to remind you, you can follow us on Twitter at What Matters NC. We're also on Facebook at What Matters NC, facebook.com at What Matters NC. You can follow me and yell at me and argue with me or tell me that you agree with me, whatever you like, at Mark Shiver on Twitter. Well, we're going to get right to our great show, Dr. Susan Roberts and special guest Hans von Spakovsky, talking about whether or not we can really expect Donald Trump to build that wall. Thank you for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Well, as the dust settles from last week's election, one of our favorite guests to talk about all things politics and elections and voting and all of that is Dr. Susan Roberts of Davidson College. Dr. Roberts, welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you so much.
Well, I've been looking forward all weekend to our conversation. A lot has happened. First of all, let's just get a broad brush. Your thoughts on the outcome of the presidential election?
Well, I think in general, people are trying to figure out what happened, or at least the Democrats are trying to figure out what happened to the firewall that they thought they had with the Democrats, with the African-Americans and the Latino vote, and if that was a prudent strategy not to visit, to have that, to that, to some extent excluding the Rust Belt. So I think that's a question of campaign strategy. And also I've been, thinking about the polling and the implications for the Republican Party, because it used to, the theme going into this election was, oh, the Republican Party is in shambles, and now people are saying, oh, the Democratic Party is in shambles, and try to see where the truth lies between those two.
Well, it really was remarkable, Dr. Roberts, the changes that we saw in the electoral map, as you mentioned, the Rust Belt. I don't think anybody in their right mind would have said that Donald Trump was going to go through and win Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania and on and on. That's just so remarkable and so very unpredictable.
Well, and I think it it spoke to the theme of populism, and that whatever the feasibility of his ideas are in translating to policy, and those are the articles I'm reading, feverishly these last few days, that it struck home. It was direct. It may have been straightforward to the point of being unrealistic, but how that message resonated and those people that turned out in areas that perhaps the Democrats had taken advantage. And I think that's a question. I don't think she spent any money to speak of in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is something that is going to have the pundits scratching their heads for a long time. And our guest, Dr. Susan Roberts, excellent professor of political science at Davidson College. So what really caught me off guard, Dr. Roberts, was, and I may have asked you this on more than one occasion, but if we go back to the primary, Donald Trump, his message resonated so strongly that he was able to just basically mow through the best of the best as far as the Republicans had to offer in terms of their primary candidates. And then I think I mentioned to you in a previous interview that it seemed like that message, that resounding, you know, momentum was not translating horizontally across the country, but I guess it was. We just didn't know.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and you may have mentioned it, but I think it bears repeating and repeating, and that is, you know, people have said the Trump voter X, the Trump voter Y, and I've been very adamant about pointing out there are different Trump voters. You can't paint everyone with a broad brush and say the Trump voter, because I think he appealed to a number of different constituencies. I don't think some of the people in some of the states were necessarily concerned with political correctness. I think they're more in terms of questions about what can he do for infrastructure, what is he going to do about regulations. And there was a real strong populist kind of impulse that perhaps hadn't been part of the Republican rhetoric during the last several presidential elections and the primaries. And so I think that was one of the questions, and I think he was able to get those people to vote. It's, you know, it's very simple. You don't have to be a political scientist to say turnout. And
yeah.
It's turnout, it's mobilization and turnout. And, you know, just want to get this in because I think it's important, is going into it, even if the polls were a little lopsided, they still had some, legitimacy. And one point that was spot on is that the enthusiasm gap. The Republicans were twice as likely to cast their be excited about casting their ballot this election than the Democrats were. And that enthusiasm gap, I think, was borne out in the results.
Oh, absolutely. One of the interesting things that I have heard, and I don't have any way to verify whether or not this is true, but I read over the weekend where it was in the Huffington Post, I think it was, that Hillary Clinton's get out the vote effort may have actually backfired because people were being reminded to go vote. And it was like, oh, yeah. And they went out and voted for Donald Trump because we saw and read and heard that he did not have a very robust ground game, so to speak, in terms of traditional thoughts of volunteers and door knocking and that sort of thing. So I don't know whether or not to put much credence in that. It's hard to really quantify how many people, you know, had their door knocked on to vote for Hillary and went out and voted for Donald. But it certainly is an interesting thought.
Well, and I think some people say we have to rewrite the campaign strategy that we've been looking at in terms of ground game, get out the vote, mobilizing, pouring ads over the media. But I think we're going to have to stop and say, well, Trump was Trump, and he got all that free media. People knew who he was. He didn't need to make name contact. And, of course, people knew who Hillary Clinton was, but I think that it just had the extra oomph. And I think that some of the people that did get out and vote, I'm not sure I think they were stealth Trump voters, although, you know, that's what people were saying before the election. I think you have to step back and say, they said shy Trump voters, but I think people that weren't going to admit to pollsters that they were going to vote for Trump. And I think that it is turning campaign strategy on its head right now, whether or not for the next couple of elections that'll be the case. Because one thing that was campaign strategy that Republicans did is they did have a pretty good idea of who was going to vote and where. They had the technological ground game that Mitt Romney did not have.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think that the Republican side has finally caught up to the great advantage that the Democrats had for a long time in terms of technology and using things like social media and that sort of thing. I can remember anecdotally when President Obama won for the first time in 2008, a friend of mine who's a Democrat said she received 60 text messages that day. Yeah. Did you vote? Have you taken your parents to vote? Have your neighbors voted? On and on and on. And the thing about David Axelrod at the time was that he was just on the leading edge of using electronic media. And I think that possibly the Republicans have finally caught up in that area. So turning our attention, Dr. Roberts, here more locally, North Carolina was seen as a big battleground state, and obviously it was, and the state voted for Donald Trump. What is your take on that?
Well, I think that there was not a very, North Carolina, I believe it's either majority, Democrats lead in terms of percentages. I think it's, you know, it's very close in terms of unaffiliated and Republican in terms of partisan identification. I don't think we had a very good handle on how the unaffiliated slash independent voter was going to lean and how much they were going to turn out. And I think perhaps Hillary Clinton overestimated her, you know, her popularity with millennials. And I think that the women's vote did not fall entirely in her camp. And I think there was probably a subtle understanding that a woman is going to vote for a woman, which is not the case because women are not a monolithic vote. So I think that those were surprises. I've never, I like what you say in terms of battleground because I reject the notion that it's a swing state. It's a battleground state. It may vote, you know, Democratic for a couple of elections or one election, but that doesn't mean that's, you know, the color of the legislature, because you look at the state legislature, it's pretty red.
Yeah.
And it isn't going to change. And in fact, the Republicans were very successful across the country with state legislatures. And I believe, and I may be wrong with a couple off, but 25 or 26, they have the trifecta in which they control the governor's mansion, the House, and the Senate. So the Republican Party has been and is real healthy at the state level. And I think now, if people want to say there's going to be a conservative agenda, well, you know, there's unified control at the top of the ticket, and there are places where it's unified control for the Republicans at the state level. So North Carolina, I think, you know, and you look at districting, and you know, redistricting is going to favor the party in power. And it was the Republicans. District lines are drawn to favor the Republicans. If you had Democrats, they would draw lines to favor the Democrats. And I think that's just real straightforward, and people have to accept that change is going to come slowly at the state level.
Our guest, Dr. Susan Roberts of Davidson College, always excellent. Now, that kind of caught me a little bit off guard. I didn't expect the North Carolina General Assembly Republicans to take any real big hits, but the House maintained its supermajority. And with the exception of Governor McCrory, the state seems pretty comfortable with the Republican leadership, even though sometimes we see polls that say people say we're going in the wrong direction. But I think they got a pretty good. They had a pretty good night in the General Assembly.
That's why I think that the ballots that came in from Durham County or from Durham were, you know, they've got some mix up in terms of when they were turned in and early voting. But if you look at it, it could be that voters were making a strategic decision, and they did not vote for Pat McCrory when they voted for Trump and for Burr. Burr, I mean, I don't have my figures right here, but Burr had a nice lead, and there was never much doubt in my mind that he wasn't going to win the election.
Yeah, Burr was obviously pulling away in most polls at the end, but in your experience, Dr. Roberts, this whole absentee ballot thing and provisional ballots, for most of what I've read, probably not going to turn the table back in Governor McCrory's favor, even though it's only 5,000 votes. I mean, anything's possible. But assuming that Roy Cooper does go ahead and win, how do you think his relationship will be going forward with the General Assembly?
I don't think he'll be very effective. And I think that, you know, it may give the Democrats in the House and the Senate some encouragement and someone that can be vocal in highlighting what they wanted to do, but what the Republicans did and overriding his veto. But I, you know, and I don't mean to disparage someone before they get into office, but I don't think he will be that effective. I might go so far as to say, and this has to do with you'd have to have exit polls, did people vote more against Pat McCrory than they did for Roy Cooper? Because I think there were people that, as we've, you know, stands to reason, and we all understand, that weren't, they took HB2, and they may have voted for it or against McCrory because of his role in it, but that wasn't just for civil liberties purposes, it was for economic purposes. And some people might just say, you know, he's really, you know, why didn't he step back? Why did he do it so quickly? And don't necessarily say this is a this impairs civil liberties and respect for others, and they might just say it was reputational. I don't think they could have. That wasn't Richard Burr's problem, and it wasn't Donald Trump's problem.
Yeah. Well, one thing that is interesting is a lot of people are trying to peg the McCrory failure to get reelected on House Bill 2. But another thing that I was told from somebody in the Charlotte area that has looked at that vote, Dr. Roberts, is that the toll roads controversy with I-77 really is what smacked him in the face because, and I haven't verified this independently, but apparently there were several precincts in Mecklenburg County that are traditional Republican strongholds that would never vote for a Democrat for governor that actually did vote for a Democrat for governor because they're just, you know, those folks are hot down there about that toll situation.
Real, I could do a focus group. I could do a person on the street interview, and that would be the top of the ticket. I mean, you almost have to be in North Mech to know how that's a reason to mobilize people and get them out to vote. You know, all the other things in terms of coal ash and other things going on, you know, the toll roads is the number one issue. And I think that you're absolutely right. That hurt him more, perhaps, than HB2, at least in this part of the county. And I think he thought he could get, you know, Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. And unfortunately, there were a lot of people that thought Pat McCrory and as mayor of Charlotte was going to be Pat McCrory as governor, and that just didn't translate.
Well, it certainly is remarkable. I know you would agree that here's a state that saw, again, the House maintain its supermajority. The Senate did very well as far as the Republican goes, and even some of the Council of State races. I mean, my goodness, Dr. Roberts, does anybody know who Mark Johnson is? Does anybody know who Mike Causey is? I mean, not to disparage them, but we're talking about strong incumbents in June Atkinson and Commissioner Goodwin for the insurance commissioner, and both of them lost. And yet, here's the top of the ticket, Governor McCrory not able to, you know, ride that momentum. It's amazing.
Well, and I think you're right. They, there was, you know, some, you know, if you don't know much about the record, you know, you might vote partisan persuasion, the little bit that you know about those candidates. But I think people knew a lot about Pat McCrory, and I think that was what hurt him. And I think I said, once again, you're not having necessarily straight ticket voting. So there were people that they took the time to vote race by race. And they didn't just pull for Trump and elect Republicans in terms of McCrory and Burr. It was a, you know, it was a long night. And, you know, as you said, wait and see how the, you know, the dust is settling. Not so much in electoral results. That's, you know, more or less in, except for McCrory. But to see how this plays out in terms of the menu of policy options. And, you know, I think for me, too, is what Trump wants to move really quickly in 100 days, and now is the Republican Party in Congress going to work with him? Or are they going to drag their heels a little bit in terms of saying, well, this is the Republican conservative ideology? To me, it's really going to be fascinating to see Trump and Ryan and also Reince Priebus now that he's in there.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. One thing we talked about in the past, I found this interesting. Evangelical voters voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. And some people are saying that, you know, Hillary Clinton didn't court them. In fact, in some of the email leaks, attacked them and spoke disparagingly about them. But it looks like 94% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. That was, you know, we haven't seen that since Reagan. And so while I was asking the question before the election, you know, how are evangelicals going to reconcile this difference between they can't support Hillary with her partial birth abortion position, but, you know, can they vote for Trump, you know, in light of the things that he had said that were disparaging to women and all of that? It looks like even if they held their nose, that they did so overwhelmingly for Donald Trump.
Yes, and I think that you know, there have been articles that said, they've said, we didn't think we know he's not, you know, our president for certain moral bearings. And I think when, if you look at South Carolina, I think Ted Cruz thought, I am going to do so well in South Carolina, and Donald Trump won the evangelical vote there. And I think that's, you know, that should have been a clue that the evangelicals could say, I'm not going to vote for someone that, and that was even before all the, you know, the Access Hollywood and some of the remarks that came out during the general election. You know, they went with Trump. And, you know, I don't know whether that people were studying that, but I think that was a message that evangelicals, again, they're not a monolith. And I think they looked at two different factors and they said, these are some of the areas that we find more important than, they don't dictate our vote. They don't necessarily say, okay, you're an evangelical, you have to go and vote on moral issues or religious issues.
Right.
And I think that, again, parsing through the different voting groups, you know, they're a healthy group of, I mean, you can't just say that white women with a college degree voted for Hillary Clinton, because that wasn't true. I mean, it was all the different fissures within these votes that sometimes we think are too, they're an easy way to explain how a group is going to vote. And you're exactly right. They may have held, they, you know, hold their nose and vote for them because they had other concerns. It doesn't mean they're going to lose those. I mean, I think they may hold Trump's feet to the fire, you know, down the road.
Yeah. So, Dr. Roberts, is this a new dawning of electoral coalitions? Obviously, it would be dumb for me to ask you to try to predict what's going to happen in 4 years. But with that caveat, in 4 years, do you think we'll see a similar coalition or electoral map that includes Republicans in the Rust Belt? Or do you think things might, you know, this was an anomaly and they might go back to what we've seen for decades?
Well, you know, I don't think, you know, I'm not going to be, I don't mean to be, those jobs aren't coming back. Some of the jobs that Donald Trump promised would come back will not come back in the same shape and form. We're not going to, you know, coal mining and some of the industries, and around here, textile industries, they'll have to be reshaped. And that could be one of the reasons that the Rust Belt abandons Donald Trump in the next presidential election. I think we can look in the midterms, but they may not be a good indicator because the midterm election's coming up. The Democrats have to defend twice as many Senate seats as they did in this election. And I think that would mean that the president, you know, maintains a healthy number and maintains the Senate. So I think the Rust Belt, a lot of that will depend on what happens with jobs. But I don't anticipate, and I would have been surprised if Trump could have said, I'm going to go with the third party. That's just not how things work here. And I think that the prospects for a third party and the Tea Party influence and the Freedom Caucus, they're going to be absorbed back into the Republican Party. And they may have some soul-searching to do in the Republican Party, but I don't believe they were in such disarray. And I think that I don't see the prospects changing, except maybe the Rust Belt going back. But I was reading an article today that the Democrats do not have the South, and you can't really have a party where you're only getting New York and California and a few other states. And so the Democrats are going to have to broaden their message. I don't see a third party, and I don't see really a realigning election, as we might say.
Well, Dr. Susan Roberts, it's always a pleasure. You have some of the best insight that I always look forward to hearing you share with our listeners, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon about what to expect in the upcoming North Carolina legislative session and in Congress. And thank you so much, as always, for being our guest on What Matters in North Carolina.
Absolutely. I truly enjoy it.
Thank you. I really enjoy talking with Dr. Susan Roberts. She's an excellent guest and always comes very well prepared for our conversations, and so we appreciate her input today and her post-election analysis. My question is, assuming for argument's sake that Roy Cooper is going to be the next governor, one of two things: he either tries to get along with and takes credit for anything good that the General Assembly does and try to, you know, get himself reelected in 2020, or he just fights them tooth and nail and uses that as a launching pad to try to get Democrats elected in 2 years. I don't know. He's not really been known as a firebrand. You know what I mean? He's always been kind of a low-key guy, in my opinion. So I can't see him really going to the mat against Senator Berger and Speaker Moore, but he might. You know, he was part of this whole evisceration thing, and it's been alleged and I think documented that he was involved with the Human Rights Campaign to actually hurt North Carolina when it comes to things like getting businesses not to come here because of House Bill 2. And so who knows what he is capable of when he gets to be governor, should that actually be the case. So it'll be definitely interesting, folks. Dr. Roberts said she didn't think he would get along at all, so we'll see. Well, Leon Russell passed away over the weekend, and if you don't remember, Leon Russell, Tightrope was his probably most famous song, but also the Songs for You. Never forget seeing Leon Russell in concert, and I had gone down back, you know, in the day when you had the Instamatic camera, you know, the thing with the big flash bulb on the top. And I'd worked my way right down to the middle of the front row, and I was getting a picture. And in mid-song, he stopped and looked at me and basically posed and opened his eyes really, really wide. And I wish I had that picture today. That would be cool to have in commemoration of his passing away. But great piano player. Elton John said that he got a lot of inspiration from Leon Russell. He was kind of a two-hit wonder, though. Never really had a lot of run on the radio back in the day after those two songs. But anyway, rest in peace, Leon Russell. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to continue our conversation as we begin to wind up our post-election analysis and look ahead to what we might can expect, for example, in this short session that's being talked about, one-day session. But we've got a great interview coming up now with Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation, and he's going to be talking about whether or not Trump can actually build that wall. So we're going to take a brief time out and get right to that very special conversation here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Are you a gun guy? Are you a gun girl? Do you know the difference between a clip and a magazine? Have you gotten into more arguments about 9mm, 40, and 45 than you care to admit? Then you need to go over to the Freedom Action Network and check out the NC Gun Dad Show, where we talk about guns, gear, accessories, and a whole lot more every week. I'm Matt Calder, and I was just another gun guy until the birth of my daughter. Then I became the NC Gun Dad. Join us weekly for a new episode of the NC Gun Dad Show, uploaded every Friday at www.freedomactionnetwork.com, and then click on the NC Gun Dad Show.
It's always a pleasure to welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina, Hans von Spakovsky. He is with the Heritage Foundation. Excellent, excellent guest. Always had has a tremendous perspective, and is in the New York Post with a op-ed that says it shouldn't be hard for Trump to build that wall. Hans, welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Well, thanks for having me back. Sure, it certainly has been an interesting week, hasn't it?
To say the least. Before we get into the specifics of immigration and walls, your overview, what did you think about last week?
Well, I'm sure, you know, all the people who voted for Trump were really happy to see him elected, but I'm sure that their second biggest pleasure was watching the heads explode of the mainstream media. Particularly the New York elites, when they were completely, like I said, overwhelmed by the fact that the candidate they were supporting, Hillary Clinton, was losing when they expected her to have an easy win.
Yeah, it really was a reason for a lot of people to kind of go back and question everything that they had been, set in stone as far as the way things were supposed to turn out. And pollsters and pundits were all just standing around with egg on their face. Did you ever believe that we would ever see, you know, the Rust Belt, Michigan, Ohio, states like that, Pennsylvania, you know, vote for the Republican candidate? That was just so remarkable.
Well, yeah, although I have to tell you, and, you know, I actually didn't write an article about it, but I told my wife about it. Listen, I actually had media credentials and was at the RNC convention, so I was on the floor when Trump made his speech, and I was struck by the fact that he in his speech, he really made the first effort that I think had been made since Ronald Reagan to talk about things that concern and would reach blue-collar Americans, you know, the hard-working people that make this country go all over the country. And I think that reach is what caused him to win places like Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it really was something else. Well, you've written about immigration, which was one of the bedrocks of his campaign platform. And so you think he should build a wall?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, everybody has derided that, but they seem to have forgotten that Congress actually authorized this back in 2006. They passed a law called the Secure Act of 2006. It was signed into law by President Bush, and they actually built many miles of a fence along the border, but it was never completed. Why? Well, because Congress never fully appropriated the money to build it. So the laws, they're already in place, and whether you want to call it a fence or a wall, it's just common sense that if you want to slow down and potentially deter and stop illegal crossing of the border, you're going to need a wall or a fence on the Mexican border with the United States.
Our guest is Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation, written an article that's in the New York Post. It shouldn't be hard for Trump to build that wall. So do you think Congress would go along with funding this and let's move ahead with this? Or what are your thoughts initially about how that would be received in a Congress? Which, by the way, he's got both houses that he should be able to work with as far as Republicans go. So is it going to be easy, do you think, for him to get some of this stuff done?
I think that he is in one of the best positions any Republican president has been in a very, very long time. Members of the House and Senate are going to be able to easily see that one of the reasons he got elected was because he promised that he would finally do something about the problem of illegal immigration. And I think they would be foolish politically not to fund and appropriate the money to complete this fence.
Now, some reports, Hans, are out there that say that, you know, he's, well, you know, maybe not this, or, you know, maybe we'll backtrack a little bit, and maybe we're, you know, and so he's, on things like Obamacare, he's already said, well, there's parts of it I like. Do you expect him to kind of soften his tone when it comes to this wall, or is this something you believe that he's earnest about?
No, I think he is earnest about it, and I'll look, a lot of what you're talking about is, again, members of the left-stream media. You know, a lot of people call it the mainstream. I like to call it the left-stream media. Look, all the very same people who are working behind the scenes to get his opponent elected are the ones who are seizing upon any little word, any little phrase of his to try to criticize him and say, oh, he's backing off. I just don't think you can make that assumption yet. We got to see what happens when he actually takes office and puts his people in place.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in terms of he had an interview last night on 60 Minutes, and he said that basically the headlines are saying he will deport 3 million illegal immigrants immediately. So that certainly doesn't sound like backing down. Now, this is not talking about the wall, but is that realistic, Hans, to start rounding folks up? And I mean, the actual, you know, intricacies and details involved with that, the practical, you know, getting the law enforcement and you know, the optics to that, I'm sure the left-stream media would love to see, you know, truckloads of people being rounded up and headed to the border. Is this something you think is realistic to do?
Oh yeah, look, it is realistic, and I'll give you just one example of what I mean. There's at least 1 million outstanding deportation orders that have not been enforced by the administration. So these are not folks who've never been caught. These aren't folks who were caught but are still, their cases are still winding their way through the immigration courts. These are people who were caught, detained, have had their day in court, and a court has said, no, you have no right to be in the U.S. We order that you be deported. And what has the administration done? They've basically not enforced those orders. Especially with the help of state and local government, state and local law enforcement, yes, they can get this done, because that'll be the opposite of what this administration has done, which is try to prevent state and local law enforcement from helping them enforce the immigration laws.
Well, our guest is Hans von Spakovsky, and what is your take on the response from the left, Hans, the protesting? I know a lot of it is folks that fuel this stuff up anyway. There's ads on Craigslist where you can make money being a protester, which is, you know, just kind of outrageous. But do you think we're going to see any of this settle down, or do you think that his, you know, rhetoric of saying, you know, stuff like we're going to deport 3 million people, is that just going to pour gas on the protesting fires?
Well, a lot of these protests are not spontaneous. We know that because we saw just, you know, a month or two ago the undercover videos released by Project Veritas, where they found Democratic campaign consultants admitting that they were training activists to engage in and foment violence at Trump rallies. And anyone who thinks that's gone away or they won't continue to do that, I think, is being foolish. Some of the people who I've seen, particularly on college campuses, these students, you know, crying and going into hysterics over this, I tell you, it saddens me, because it seems that many of our college students today have the emotional stability of six-year-olds.
Yeah, I think that I don't have the words, Hans, for some of this stuff. I know that there were reports that the University of Michigan was handing out Play-Doh, you know, to college students, and I'm just without words. It's just unbelievable how the reaction, and I certainly hope that a lot of this is just reporting and not real, that there really aren't that many college students in need of safe places and who are walking around crying and needing to play with Play-Doh. I mean, I think that would speak an enormous negative to the state of higher education in our country.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, I saw that myself also. And I was sitting there thinking, have we really regressed that much? I mean, think about the kids of the same age who, on December 10th, 1941, were faced with going into and fighting a world war. I don't think Play-Doh was being handed out, or people were being given stuffed animals to help them emotionally back then, when we were faced with a really serious problem.
Yeah, that's an excellent analogy and point, and I appreciate you mentioning that. So back to your article about the wall in the New York Post, and our listeners can find that at nypost.com. It shouldn't be hard for Trump to build that wall. Hans von Spakovsky wrote that. It's an excellent piece, and he's our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. You talk about the National Border Patrol Council, and they have recommended several steps. And first of all, building a wall on the southern border. And as you point out, Congress authorized this thing a decade ago. Well, maybe they'll fund it this time around. But you talk about ending sanctuary cities and turning off the jobs and benefits magnet. Here in North Carolina, there are a lot of refugees that this is a big concern, because, Hans, they tell the governor and they tell the folks in charge that, well, you know, we don't really know the background of these refugees, but here they are. And in addition to the sanctuary cities, do you think that's something that can be dealt with is just this random depositing of refugees into states like North Carolina without any kind of awareness or understanding or information, you know, as to who these people are or where they've come from?
Oh yeah. And in fact, if folks go to the Trump website, that's part of his immigration policy. I mean, he's got a very extensive policy laid out of what they intend to do, which I found to be both common sense and effective. And one of the things they talk about that they're going to do is they're going to suspend issuing visas to any country that exports terrorism and lacks adequate screening of visa applicants. If the FBI is telling the Department of Homeland Security, we can't vet the background of these individuals, why in the world would we bring them into the country? That is a basic step you take before you bring someone in. And it's not that we're being unwelcome to refugees. We're just saying, look, we've got to be able to vet your background before you let you in today's world of international terrorism.
Yeah, well, it certainly makes sense, and maybe that's the problem. It makes too much sense. Yeah, exactly. So you talk also about terminating immediately President Obama's illegal amnesty programs. Here's my question, and I know you don't have a crystal ball and you can't predict this, Hans, but a lot of this stuff, and I alluded to it before, people are somewhat, you know, on the left, they're freaking out already before Trump's done anything. Would the American people, do you think, by and large, accept this kind of, radical response to illegal immigration? Or do you think that across the, you know, the spectrum that people really want this and will welcome it?
Oh, I think people really want this and welcome it. And look, the left tries to paint this as being anti-immigrant. That is not at all true. Americans are more welcoming of immigrants than any other nation in the world. But what we welcome is legal immigration. And one of the reasons Trump won was because people are tired of the left trying to merge illegal and legal immigration into the same thing, and the government being unwilling to do anything about illegal immigration. They want the illegal immigration problem ended. That doesn't mean they have anything against the legal immigration, which has made us a great country.
Well, Hans, I appreciate you being available to us this morning on short notice, and it's good information. I will again mention the New York Post, nypost.com, and Hans von Spakovsky's article there. Very well written, very informative, and, it kind of creates a sense of hope that it shouldn't be hard for Trump to build that wall, and the things that you've laid out here seem to be doable, and, wow, wouldn't that be amazing if they were actually done? I think America would certainly have to take notice, you know? I mean...
Oh, I agree. Listen, if he does nothing else other than enforce his promises on immigration, he's going to guarantee himself getting reelected in 4 years.
Oh, absolutely. Hans, thank you very much for being our guest today on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I always enjoy talking with Hans von Spakovsky, legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's always, he just kind of sounds like he's laid back, just kicking back, you know, not really having to think real hard about the answers because he's a really smart guy. And yet he's conversational and makes everything really easy to understand. So we appreciate him, as always, being our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. So talking about the Supreme Court here in North Carolina, as you know, Justice Edmonds lost his bid for re-election to Wake County Superior Court Judge Mike Morgan. A lot of factors in play there. A lot of people are saying that the location of the names on the ballot, the fact that now we have in the appeals court, you know, it's obvious who's an R and who's a D, but not on the Supreme Court. And so even, you know, not being critical at all of Senator Berger's office, but I saw these, social media posts from Senator Berger's office a few days before the election, and it just had a picture of Mike Morgan, and it was an article attached to it from actually, I think, Susan Myrick here at the Civitas Institute. But coming so close to the election there, you have to wonder how many people are going to actually read the article and instead just saw Phil Berger, Mike Morgan, and maybe thought, you know, subconsciously that that was some kind of connection there. So a lot of different things, you know, that may or may not have had anything to do with it, but a lot of different things went into the whole result there of Justice Edmonds not getting reelected. You know, they had that retention election thing, remember that, where the General Assembly passed a law that he would just have to basically be voted on, is he doing a good job or not, and if he was, he'd keep his seat. And that was struck down, interestingly enough, by Justice Martin, this panel, remember? There were six, and because there was no majority, the lower court decision, which said that the retention election was not constitutional. The whole thing just, I don't know, it seemed like the cards were stacked against Justice Edmonds. But anyway, the General Assembly now rumored to be wanting to expand up to two more justices. And I don't know. What do you think about that? It's kind of like when they did the Wake County School Board, the Wake County Commission, you know, drawing the lines and did the same thing in Greensboro. And I know there's precedent here. In 2000, the General Assembly expanded the Court of Appeals. At that time, Governor Hunt was in his final term and or final year, whatever. And they expanded the appeals court to 15. But I don't know. My initial thought, my opinion only, not representing anybody, just me, I don't like the idea. Now, I've had some friends over the weekend tell me, oh, no, this is a great idea. We need to do it. But I personally just think, you know, sometimes you just, well, I mean, I was saying earlier in the show, people need to accept the results of the presidential election. So sometimes you just need to accept the results. But then again, you know, in Pope v. Easley back in 2000, you know, lawsuit about whether or not the General Assembly could expand the Court of Appeals, and the Democrats did that. But it's hard to keep doing things and saying, well, the Democrats did that, you know, the redistricting, the quote gerrymandering. You know, you can definitely honestly say legitimately, you know, Democrats gerrymandered for 100 years. And I love this hypocrisy, this faux shock that Democrat leftists have when it comes to gerrymandering. Oh my gosh, gerrymandering. You know, like they've never heard of it or never seen it take place before when their party did it. But, you know, at some point, you just need to stop, you know, and you can't keep saying, well, the Democrats did it. Because sometimes you just, you know, just blaming or justifying what you're doing because somebody else did it, I don't know how far that will continue to get you. Now, I do agree with the drawing of districts, that that's something that, you know, the Republicans had never gotten to do. And they did it in 2010 and based on that census. And frankly, I think that was a good thing. But all these people, oh, we need to have, you know, bipartisan district drawing. Yeah, good luck with that. It's just not going to happen. Even if you call it bipartisan, there's always going to be somebody that's favored more than somebody else. One party that turns out better than the other in those kind of situations. So anyway, is it the toll roads issue that cost Governor McCrory the governor's race? You know, Nick Oxner was on here with us Thursday, and we appreciate Nick. But you remember he brought it up. There was several precincts. North Mecklenburg delivered 15,500 more votes for Roy Cooper in 2016 versus what was voted in 2012 in McCrory's race against Bev Perdue. You know, it's only 4,000 or so votes. So if, in fact, McCrory does end up losing, well, there it is right there. North Mecklenburg, like Nick Oxner said, very likely cost him the race. And why is that? Because of the toll roads. You know, we heard about that kind of tangentially. We talked about it quite a bit several months ago here on the show. But that was a big deal to those folks down there. And they sure let everybody know it was a big deal when they went to vote. So that could actually have been the thing that that took Cooper over the top. Well, thank you for listening to today's What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. We're so glad that you've been a part of the program. We will have another excellent program for you again tomorrow, as always. And be sure to remind your friends and family to find us at freedomactionnetwork.com or in the iTunes and Google Play stores. Until tomorrow, thanks for listening to What Matters in North Carolina.